Good morning. This morning I want to talk to you about the resurrection. Imagine, if you will, that your worst enemy has been defeated. Imagine, if you will, the person who comes at you the most, the person who's creating the most issues in your life, they are gone away. And finally you have some comfort, some peace, some celebration of your victory. It's with this attitude that you can imagine how the demons and evil felt on Sunday morning. Bitter hate had struck down its victim. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the Herodians, the secular group of the day, they had gone home. They returned to their houses satisfied. Finally, we've gotten rid of this guy. We've gotten rid of the troublemaker. We've gotten rid of the guy who keeps causing us these problems. Sure, the demons, they rejoiced that the one that they had feared the most was in a tomb. Jesus had been crucified, that he was dead, that he was buried, that he was enclosed in a tomb, and wax is put around it so that no one could move it out of the way. And they celebrate. It was the best Passover of their life. But then on Sunday morning, instead of Easter being a day of victory for Jesus' enemies, Easter sunrise, you can imagine it. At Easter sunrise, it was a day of victory, not for the enemies, but for Jesus. It was a day of proclamation that Jesus' enemies have been defeated. It was a day of proclamation that death was no longer what had to be, but that new life was what would be. Early on the Sunday morning, these women come. They want to pay their respects, if you will. They want to do what's traditional in their time, and that is to put spices on the body, to anoint the body. They were very rushed because Jesus is taken down from the cross, and at nightfall they could no longer do anything because it was Passover the next day. It was their Sabbath. They couldn't do any work, and so the women are just shut up in the house all day Saturday. You can imagine these women are bursting at the seams, ready to get out of the house and go to the tomb to respectfully anoint the body of Jesus. You can imagine their conversation back and forth, you know, like, did you bring everything we were supposed to have? And another woman starts saying, well, who's going to move the rock for us? And maybe there's somebody there that can help us out. You know, what are the things these women are talking about? Maybe they just go in total silence. But sunrise comes up. And Jesus transforms history. Jesus changes absolutely everything. This morning I want to read again this account of the women who are going to look for a dead man But instead of finding a dead man, they meet these angels who ask them an important question. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? Why are you looking for the living among the dead? Luke's account of this in chapter 24 tells us that on the first day of the week, very early in that morning, they came to the tomb bringing the spices that they had prepared, and they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. Can you imagine that these women, maybe there's a sigh of relief that, okay, we can get in. Or maybe there's wonder, or maybe there's fear, like what happened? Why isn't the tomb like it should be? So they see the stone is rolled away, and verse 3 says, so they went in, but they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. Imagine what's going on in their heads. They saw him dead. They saw where he was buried. Verse 4 picks up and says, and while they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men stood by them in dazzling clothes. So the women were terrified and bowed down to the ground. And the men asked, why are you looking for the living among the dead? He is not here, but he has resurrected. Remember how he spoke to you when you were still in Galilee, saying, the Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and rise on the third day. See, Jesus had predicted what would happen to him over and over again. Matter of fact, in the book of Mark, we see it happened 3 times. And when the angel reminds them of this, verse 8 says, they remembered his words. Not the angel's words, but they remembered Jesus' words. They remembered that Jesus had said he was going to die and rise again. And finally, the dots begin to connect. So they leave. It says, returning from the tomb, they reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them were telling the apostles these things. But these words seemed like nonsense to them. And they didn't believe the women. Peter, however, got up, ran to the tomb, and when he stooped to look in, he saw only linen clothes. So he went home amazed at what happened. This morning I want to talk to you about Jesus' resurrection. Not just Jesus' resurrection, but some of the implications that it has for you and for me. The first thing that we got to see is that Jesus' resurrection proves that he was God. It proves he was God. Either you believe Jesus is God or you don't. There are a lot of people nowadays who say Jesus was a good prophet. He was a good man. He was a philosopher, a thinker. He was a teacher. He was a social revolutionary guy. He worried about the small man, and so he cared about the little person. And so they want to discount what Jesus really teaches about himself. They want to say Jesus was just a good guy. And by doing that, they want to strip him of his divinity and say, he's not God, he's not God's son, he is just a smart fellow. Yet you have to look at Jesus' life and say, well, what does Jesus say about himself? Does Jesus say he's just a revolutionist? Does he just say he's a guy who wants to overthrow the social fabric of the time? Does he just saying that he's a teacher? Is he saying he's a philosopher? No. What he says is that he's the Son of God. Jesus, the only one who's able to predict that he would die and that he would rise again. So we're left with two choices. Either Jesus is who he says he is, or is he a complete liar? There's really no middle ground. How can a moral guy, how can a good teacher, how can a revolutionary be a liar? Is he really a good guy then? Is he really a philosopher then? Is he really a moral teacher if he is a liar? And if he's not a liar, then he must be God. One of my favorite writers is C.S. Lewis. And one of my favorite quotes from C.S. Lewis has to do with this very thing. In the 1940s, C.S. Lewis records, or he does some radio talks. He goes on the radio and he does, over a period of time, he does several talks about just the existence of a God, and then he gets to who that God is. And later on, that those talks are transferred into writing, and we have the book Mere Christianity. C.S. Lewis gave the talk, C.S. Lewis wrote it, and in that book, he's talking about who Jesus is, who he says he is. And I want to read to you that quote. It's a little lengthy, but stay with me. C.S. Lewis says, "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him being God, or him being Jesus. And this is what they say: I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the same level as the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let's not come with this patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. And he did not intend to. Jesus' resurrection was an actual, historical, real event. People saw him after he raised. People saw him dead. People put him in a tomb. And then after this day, they saw him resurrected. So his resurrection demonstrates that he is God. And if Jesus is who he says he was, then his resurrection is the foundation for Christianity. Jesus' resurrection is the foundation of Christianity. The book of 1 Corinthians, if you would go there, if 1 Corinthians chapter 15, all of chapter 15, Paul is making the argument that the resurrection is the foundation of Christianity. Without the resurrection, we have no Christianity. Without the resurrection, Paul says, I'm wasting my time. Without the resurrection, he's lying to you. Without the resurrection, Christianity is a hopeless, empty message. In verses 13 and 14, Paul will write, but if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised. He's making the argument for you and us being resurrected one day. He's also saying if you don't believe that resurrection's possible, then you're saying that Christ has not raised either. So if there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation is without foundation. And so is your faith. Paul says, without the resurrection, we have no message. Without the resurrection, there is no Christianity. Without the resurrection, we just have a set of guidelines of how to live a quote-unquote good life. But Paul says there's so much more to life than being quote-unquote good in the sight of others. There is worship of God. There is resurrection. And Paul's saying, my message is not empty. My message is not without foundation. My message begins with the resurrection of God. Without the resurrection, we have no Messiah. Without the resurrection, there's no truth in Christ. Without the resurrection, we have no message in Christianity. You need to understand that the grave and the cross were not interruptions to Jesus' plan. The grave was not some side road that he decided to take and make the best out of. The grave, the resurrection, the crucifixion, his death, and eventual resurrection were all part of the plan. They were not interruptions to his work of salvation. They were his works of salvation. So Jesus is much more than a moral lawgiver. Jesus is much more than a guy who tells you how to be nice to your friends and your family and your enemies. Jesus died for you. Jesus raised again. And if that's true, the last thing I want us to see is that Jesus' resurrection points to our own. Jesus' resurrection points to our future resurrection. For some reason in Christianity, we think that we're going to die and go to heaven, and that's the it. That's the end. That heaven is my home. But in truth, God teaches, Jesus teaches. In his teaching, Jesus says, well, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And in order to be in this new heaven and this new earth, you will be raised again. That the graves will be open, you will have a new body, you will be raised again. You don't die and go to a forever place, you go to a waiting place. It is heaven. I'm not trying to dispel that. What I'm saying is it's not the final place. The final place is a new heaven and a new earth after resurrection. Jesus is pledging that you will be resurrected if you are his. That you will be made new if you are a child of his. Again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul says, but now Christ has been raised from the dead. He is the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead also comes through a man. What you need to understand there is the word he uses there is first fruits. And those of us who are not farmers, we don't really understand what first fruits may be. First fruits is exactly what it sounds like. It's the first fruits you get. In order for something to be first, there must be something that comes later, right? My children always argue about who's first. I'm going to be first, or I want to do this first. You tell one to take a bath, the other one runs and says, I'm going to be first. It means that if there's a first, that there's more to follow. And Paul uses this word very intentionally. He says Jesus is the first fruits. Again, he's using an analogy from agriculture. But what he's saying is, if Jesus is first, there has to be more. And Jesus is the first fruits of those who have raised from the dead. Therefore, his resurrection is real. But the implication is that after Jesus, more will be raised. What Jesus teaches us and what Scripture teaches us is that when time comes, when we don't know when that time is, Jesus comes back. Paul teaches us in chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians, when Jesus comes back, the graves open and resurrection happens. And that your forever home is a new heaven and a new earth in a resurrected body. The problem is too many of us live in a life or live in a way in which we think that this body is the best there is. We think that this life is the best there is. And we don't act like there is something after our death. And too many of us live like people who miss the importance of the resurrection. That the resurrection gives us faith to live the way we live. The resurrection gives us foundation for everything that we believe. The resurrection is why we are here today. So do we live like we're looking for a dead man? Or do we live worshiping, loving, adoring a living man, a living God, who is no longer among the dead, but he is raised again? Beyond death is life. Beyond the grave is glory. The Marys, they saw the empty tomb. John and Peter, they saw the empty tomb. The soldiers that were there saw the empty tomb. The disciples would see him in the upper room a little bit later. Then again in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul tells us that at one time over 500 of Jesus' followers saw him at one time. Jesus really rose from the grave. And one day we can rise from the grave if we belong to him. And if you're not his, will you come to him today? If he's not your God, if he is just some guy that you think about from time to time, so maybe you come to church every once in a while, whatever it is, but you've not totally given him your life, every aspect of it, will you do that today? The night that Jesus was taken to be prosecuted, to go through this process of this trial that he would have, eventually be executed, he had a very special meal with his disciples. It's a Jewish tradition, and it has so much meaning that I don't have time to go through it right now. But at that meal, there were several cups of wine, and there was bread, and Jesus really changes the way that those things were to be understood. See, Passover looks back to Israel being freed from the bondage of Israel. And Jesus turns that meaning on its head and says, you are going to be freed from bondage, but it's not the bondage of Egypt. It is the bondage of your sin. So the meal for us as believers, while we can respect and appreciate all the meanings that it had in a Jewish context, for a Christian, it means new life and anticipation of a coming king and a coming resurrection. At the Lord's Supper, Jesus gives bread and he gives wine and he gives the juice, he gives the cup, he gives these things to his disciples, and he says, whenever you do it in remembrance of me until I come again. So the Lord's Supper is a twofold remembrance. It's a remembrance of his sacrifice and his resurrection, but it's also a remembrance that he said he's coming again, and we live in anticipation. So this morning, I want us to take the Lord's Supper together. It's a great day to remember his sacrifice, but also live in anticipation of what is to come. The next few minutes, would you spend time reflecting personally on what Jesus did? What's going on in your life? Maybe there's some sin you need to confess. If you want to come to the altar, you can do that. If you want me to pray with you, I'll do that. But while that's going on, I'm going to ask that the deacons come and begin to prepare for us to do the Lord's Supper.